This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, cover language with shiplap. Coming up in today's show, obstacle courses for words. On with the show. Gather round, everybody. It's story time.
Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. Then came a lot of titillating tabloid speculation and slanderous allegations. He was stepping out with a red-headed waitress, and he was in debt to the tune of $40,000. He pled not guilty to murder and insisted that the cocaine in the glove compartment was a plant. He was found guilty of mismanagement of public funds and sentenced to 600 hours of community service. He went into self-imposed exile, and after a while, the noise died down. The scandal had no discernible effect on his career.
That sounds unorthodox. This is not only not from the usual book of Genesis, it's not from a usual book.
Yeah, well, my name is Jez Burrows. I'm a designer and illustrator, and I'm the author of a book called Dictionary Stories, Short Fictions, and Other Findings.
And what is Dictionary Stories?
Dictionary Stories is a collection of short stories. There's about 160 of them-ish, and all of them are entirely composed of example sentences taken from a variety of dictionaries.
Now, why would you do a thing like that to yourself?
That's a really good question. why would I do that? Well, I was at home on a Friday night reading the dictionary because I'm a very exciting person with a lot of friends and plans.
You're talking to your kind of people.
Oh, that's true. I don't need to explain myself. Yeah, okay.
Be proud.
Yeah, I was reading the dictionary on a Friday night and it was fantastic. And I was looking at the definition of a word, study, and instead of concentrating on the definition, I was reading instead the example sentence for it, which was, he perched on the edge of the bed, a study in confusion and misery, which is pretty heady stuff for a dictionary, not necessarily the thing that I was planning on finding. That kind of tipped me off that I had never really paid a lot of attention to these example sentences before, and they all seemed like little fragments of larger stories. And so the book is an attempt to try and write those stories, or rewrite those stories, I suppose.
These sentences Jez is talking about are an essential part of lexicography. A dictionary will collect written samples of every sense in which a word is used, sometimes thousands per word, gathered over decades or even centuries. Then, when compiling or updating that dictionary, the lexicographer will select example sentences that best demonstrate the usages of that word. These citations vary from dictionary to dictionary, as each dictionary will draw on different written sources, and each dictionary has a slightly different style and editorial intent. So Jez had quite the variety of material at his disposal, garnered from several dictionaries.
It was a dozen dictionaries, and yeah, what it ultimately took the form of, which I imagine will make for great radio, is spreadsheets.
I love spreadsheets.
Me too. I'm a big fan.
It's an unspoken pleasure, the spreadsheet.
It's forbidden, almost, you know?
It's just private.
Yeah. Yeah, what I do with my spreadsheet in my house is my business, really.
You're not harming anyone?
No.
You're just organizing data.
But yes, just a lot of spreadsheets. I would start categorizing all the sentences that I've found. These sentences would be great for a drama or a murder mystery or a romance, or these sentences have a particular linguistic structure. You know, they begin with a particular pronoun, or they would be great at the beginning of the story or the end of a story. Sentences about mystery, sentences about nature, sentences about parties or politics. But then there are all these subcategories, you know, sentences that have a cardinal or an ordinal number, sentences that use Yiddish, sentences that are in the form the X of Y, like the accumulation of wealth or the advent of television. The most useful ones, I will say, so I have a whole section where it's just sentences that begin with the word don't, sentences that begin with the words I was, and I think maybe the most fortuitous one was sentences that begin with it's, just the contraction it's, because they always tended to be kind of colloquial. It's going to be a doozy of a black eye. It's blatantly her first kiss. It's been about a week since I last blogged. They're just stuff that I would not anticipate on being in the dictionary. It's been an absolute bastard of a week. Great.
That does seem a little more personality-filled than they're often allowed to be when compiling dictionary.
Yeah. Well, I think the best example that I found was gallon as a unit of measurement, and the example sentence for it was just gallons of fake blood.
Of all the things to choose.
I know! Like, milk, water.
Petrol.
Blood, real blood. Somehow real blood is less creepy than specifying that it's fake blood, but I always really enjoy that one, and that's my favorite example of just, like, someone had to make that choice. The worse the example sentence is, it's almost as if the better it becomes for my usage, one that is very distracting because there's a lot of fiction in it, or it, you know, it's such an interesting sentence that you're not concentrating on what it says about the usage of the word, then that becomes very, very useful for me.
I don't know that I'd consciously thought about the example sentences very much at all until this time in both of our lives.
Uh-huh.
But it actually must be quite a hard task for them to choose one where it demonstrates unambiguously that particular sense of the word.
Yeah. It's such a rigorous process, and they need to meet so many criteria. The examples aren't provided for whimsy's sake. Like, they're an instructive piece of language. They need to complement that definition and help your understanding of it, and it can't be too interesting. It can't be too distracting.
But then you're trying to make something interesting out of a collection of deliberately not interesting sentences.
Yes. Yeah, it was a rough year.
I'm sorry, guys.
So it was a lot of collecting and then categorizing, and then the biggest portion of it ultimately was just kind of a trial and error, kind of like collage, just pushing sentences together and see if they fit, and then trying to aim for getting a coherent story out of all of these disparate pieces. Dictionaries all share the same intent, so it was interesting watching how they differed when they would specifically try and define the same word and then also try and provide a sample of it. And everybody's supposed to be impartial, everybody's supposed to be invisible author, but even the trace differences from dictionary to dictionary, it was really fascinating. And I guess the thing it just confirmed to me about language is the interpretation of it can differ so wildly, even through people who are attempting to define it and to explain to us all how to use it.
Were there any things that you found particularly difficult?
Writing dialogue that felt natural with found content is just a nightmare. Because I was using found content, I think I learned to not begin a story thinking, I'm going to write a story about X or Y, and you know, this character is going to do these things. Because you have to find all of those, you literally have to find all of that content. So I think teaching myself to just submit to whatever I found in the dictionary and let it tell me what the story was going to be about and have that be fine, that took a while to kind of adjust to, but it created some stories that I think I would never have written just by myself if I was just writing short stories of my own.
Are you naturally drawn to creative restrictions?
Yes, definitely.
Why?
Generally, I'm a designer and illustrator by trade, and I'm often working within constraints on those kinds of projects. Like, I'm given a typeface or a color palette or, you know, a set of images that I need to work from. So it's just kind of my natural way of working. And particularly as a first-time author, it also felt like a nice sort of springboard into being able to write these stories, because I could rely on the constraint. I was really inspired by a lot of the rises of the Oulipo.
The Oulipo is a group founded in France in 1960, dedicated to creating art with constraints, such as lipograms, excluding certain letters, or univocalism, using only one vowel in a whole piece, or palindromes, which read the same backwards as forwards, or composing poems using only words in the limited lexicon of a computer language, or writing to mathematical rules. Why? To spark new ideas, to experiment, to alleviate the fear of the blank page.
I feel like one of the Oulipean sort of ethos is, you know, if you sit someone down and ask them to write poetry, they're going to look at you like a sort of terrified rabbit. But if you ask them to write poetry without using the letter E, like, it suddenly becomes a puzzle instead of writing poetry. And what people produce tends to be kind of looser and kind of more interesting. So, yeah, I think it's a really useful tool for writing just in general.
It's like doing really lame drugs. You know, you haven't got access to any, like, psilocybins, but, you know, you can mess with grammar.
It's legal, though.
It's absolutely legal.
Ross Sutherland is a poet and performer. You've heard him on his podcast, Imaginary Advice, and he's fond of a writing constraint.
I first discovered the Ulupo in my 20s, and I was writing before, but like as soon as I started reading about the Ulupo, it really helped me understand like my relationship with writing, and it helped me articulate like the purpose of writing for me.
Why?
My early writing is like very, very cliched. Like lots of the poetry which I was kind of writing in my early 20s, surprise, surprise, not particularly great.
You're not alone.
Pretty didactic, me getting on a soapbox. I was quite a polemic kind of writer. And what the Ulupo really helped show me was that, like, you know, our minds are sort of stuck in ruts. We're trapped in thought patterns that we repeat every day. And it's hard to examine the validity of those thoughts because we're thinking them without realizing that we're doing it. But through writing, we can force ourselves out of those ruts. And I think what the Ulupo are really good at, putting arbitrary rule systems into writing that block you from using the obvious answer and force you to sort of explore new territories instead. And I think what I loved about that was this idea of launching into writing when you yourself don't know where you're going, and just allowing your subconscious to more lead you on the journey. Now, of course, like, there's nothing like special about the Ulupo. I think they're kind of what they're doing, like, particularly what poetry is always doing, which is using arbitrary rule systems. Poetry will have like a sonnet form, and you know, that's got a line length and a rhyme scheme, etc. And I suppose like grammar itself is a set of rules which can't help but shape the way that we think. So you take those existing rule systems and you just start tinkering with those rules, you start adding to the rules or taking rules away, and naturally that changes the way that language works, and that changes the way that our brains work. The harder you make the rules, the deeper into your subconscious you go. And in fact, in order to reach a level of freedom, it's not about removing the rules, it's about adding rules. And I think this was partly because like the Ulupo were sort of half scholars of literature and then half sort of mathematicians, is that they kind of thought, well, maybe by flooding the work with rules and making it like punishingly difficult to write, you have to go deeper inside yourself. You have to root around in your subconscious. And if you can find an answer to the puzzle that you've set yourself, that was something that you had to look so hard for. Yeah, the Ulupo, they described themselves as rats trying to escape a maze of their own construction.
And when you were driven deep into your own subconscious, what did you find?
Well, okay, so first of all, so my first form that I tried out was univocalism, also known as a univocal lipogram, which is a poem that only contains one vowel.
Huh.
So they're really fun to do. It is like learning like another language.
Which vowel did you choose?
I did O.
Lovely.
I think all the vowels do have like a different kind of personality. I think O is quite melancholy. As far as I understand it, like when you write librettos for baritones, they have quite a lot of like round chocolatey vowel sounds, and that's quite good for like a baritone. And baritones are quite kind of melancholy. You're meant to sort of fall in love with a baritone. Whereas like tenors are given reedy, meaner sounds. So like I think E is a slightly more needling sound. Like,
well, it's formed higher up in your mouth, isn't it?
Yeah, that's probably it, isn't it? Yeah. And the less said about you, the better.
Very difficult vowel.
The more difficult it gets, the more scatological it gets.
Oh, right.
And I think that's possibly because your ability to express yourself when that's reduced, you want to rattle the cage a little bit. You're a little bit like a trapped animal. And so as sort of language gets smaller and smaller, there's a tendency to get quite rude and quite juvenile. So everybody that I know who's attempted a univocalism, they end up being like quite juvenile somewhere. Like they get quite rude.
All right. So you go deep into your subconscious and you find a 12-year-old.
You find a 12-year-old. Yeah. Yeah. My poem I ended up writing was about a bunch of teenagers drinking in a park that get so wasted that they can't find their way home again. And so there was lines like, Rob shows Gordon how to body pop. Slow Robocop foxtrot to Bobby Brown.
That is surprisingly long sentence, given that you're only allowed to use O.
Yeah, you repeat people's names a lot. That's quite useful. And I think they do end up being quite story-led. Me and a few of my friends, we wrote a whole bunch of univocalisms, and we got an opportunity to read them in front of actual members of the Ulupo. And we were so excited, and they were so disappointed. because we used Y.
Ross has tried out several writing constraints, such as in his play Party Trap, which is palindromic.
You have to watch like 35 minutes of this play before you even get to the interesting bit. where to start kind of like moving back.
And the Oulipo technique, known as S plus 7 or N plus 7.
Which is where you take an existing text and then you replace every noun and verb from the original text with the word seven places below it in the dictionary. Or at least that's what the Oulipo originally suggested. They suggest like seven places below. But I think it really depends on the size of your dictionary. I did an adaptation of Little Red Riding Hood in N plus 7, which becomes liverish, red-blooded, riff-raff, hoo-ha. Grandma becomes Great Britain, so it feels like weirdly political.
Did you ever cheat on the rules?
I give myself a lot more liberties with that kind of thing. I think when it comes to like the final editing stuff, for example, in like the Red Riding Hood ones, which I did was like 23 places below, I cheated all the time. All the time. If I saw if the word before it or afterwards better, I just choose that. Because actually, like, I don't want to feel like, wow, I can make this so much better piece if I wasn't stuck with these dang rules. No, like, I would absolutely go off-piste if it makes something better. But I'm quite comfortable if someone was to call shenanigans on those pieces.
Well, who's the umpire? It's you.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll do what I want. It's my party.
Well, also, what's most important? Is it the audience for the work? Is it the rules and adherence to the rules? Or is it your own satisfaction?
Yeah, good point. Right, and done badly, playing with rules just looks like showing off, right? It just looks like, look at this big obstacle course that I've created. Look at how clever I am jumping all around it. That is just like self-gratification. And I would say if it is done well, then you're giving the audience the tools to continue to create that world without you. And it's hopefully pointing at something more than the sum of its parts.
So would you say ultimately the rules are to stimulate art and creativity, but they are not the art themselves?
They're not the art themselves. They're like an opening into art. They're a way to disrupt thought patterns and a way to begin the process of mapping our thoughts in a more interesting way. But it's a launch pad, right? You have to take the ideas that it gives you. They have to live on their own. They have to live outside of the game. Like, we're taught from a young age to be good sports at losing games. Like, sportsmanship as a concept is all about being a good loser. And yet, like, we're terrified of the concept of losing art. That's like, it'd be a horrible thing to put yourself out there and for it to kind of fail. So if you can reframe it as a game, then like all the better.
Because if you fail at the game, you've just failed at the game, not at art entirely.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, you know, you fail at the game, but then like you can play again. It's less of a kind of like of a referendum on your own self-worth if you lose a game. Because we play games all the time. So we're very comfortable with our odds. Whereas I feel like when it comes to art, the odds feel a little bit more important. And they shouldn't.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is wrangle, noun, rare, gravel given to a hawk to improve its digestion. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, and Martin Austwick, who also makes the music you hear in each episode. Jez Burrows is the author of the book Dictionary Stories, which is out now. He's also a designer and illustrator and has some intriguing new projects brewing. Find his work at jezburrows.com. Ross Sutherland makes the podcast Imaginary Advice. He's also doing a live tour this autumn. Find his work at rosssutherland.co.uk. Find me online. Illusionist Show is the handle on Facebook and Twitter. And you can find further information about every episode and additional reading matter, as well as transcripts and the full dictionary entry for each randomly selected word of the day at the show's home, theillusionist.org.